Session open. I'm Greg Robinson. I'm Associate Professor of History at l'Université du Québec à Montréal, University of Quebec at Montreal for the Anglophones. I'm very happy to be the moderator for this panel and on sharing historic space, African Americans, Native Americans, and Nikkei. And I wanted to introduce briefly the three panelists who will be speaking. And then they will be speaking a maximum of 18 minutes each. I will be very nasty otherwise. And then I will speak for a very, very short time. And then we will have plenty of time to talk with all of you. Our first panelist is Sarah Begay. Sarah is an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation and a lifelong resident of the Navajo Reservation. She's presently a special education teacher at Chilchinbeto Community School, Incorporated, located near Monument Valley. She received her Master's of Arts in Teaching Special Education from Western New Mexico University in Silver City, New Mexico. Ms. Begay has been an educator for more than 33 years, of which 22 were devoted to classroom teaching predominantly of Navajo students. She also taught gifted students at Loop Schools in Arizona who documented oral stories and history, including the virtually unheard of Loop Penal Colony, which she'll be talking about today. Our second panelist to my middle left is Martha Nakagawa. Martha is a longtime community member, journalist, who's worked in the Asian American press for the past two decades. It seems like five times that much. Given all that she's produced, and has been on the staff with Asia Week, Rafu Shimpo, and the Pacific Citizen. She's contributed to Nikkei West, Hakube Mainichi, Nichibei Times, and God only knows what else. Our third panelist is Dr. Ruth Yoshiko Okamoto, who is a former employee of Wells Fargo Bank for 13 years, who later became Director of Admissions at the California College of Arts and Crafts. She received her BA from Mills College, and then in 1991, she took early retirement from Wells Fargo and attended graduate school at the California School for Professional Psychology, receiving both an MA and a PhD. She has been an organizational consultant, a researcher, a writer. She's best known for her project Sharing a Desert Home, published by Heyday Books, as a special report of the news from Native California. She is currently a liaison for the Colorado River Indian tribes to the Japanese American community of former post and internees to preserve and restore what remains of a few internee constructed buildings on the post and Camp One site. She is an artist and a creative spirit, and so I hope you will welcome them all.
Because this is being recorded for streaming, we are going to have all of the questions repeated by the panelists into the mic. The panelists will have to speak into the mic, and then they will answer the questions that they asked.
Hello in Navajo. I just want to start off by saying that I was pleasantly surprised by the young lady over there. She's from Window Rock, close to where I come from. And then the gentleman with the turquoise bolo tie, you make me feel comfortable. Back in 2000, when I worked at the Loop Schools Incorporated in Loop, Arizona, someone made a joke about Japanese caskets floating down the Little Colorado River after the flooding that it caused. And I asked, what caskets? What Japanese? And that's all. And the guy said, oh, they used to be over there at Old Loop School. And from there, we started inquiring. It was just a joke. He was just making a crazy joke. Anyway, I will tell you about what we found. Go back to the reservation. You'll see where Loop is. It's near Flagstaff, just right off I-40. And then I come from Chilchinbeto. I wish I had one of those laser pointers, but it's close to where that arrow is pointing, and Loop is down below. We as Navajo people call ourselves Diné, the people. This is Dok Oosli, the San Francisco Peaks, that's easily seen from Loop if you look toward the west. Dok Oosli is sacred because it marks the western boundary of the traditional Navajo land. This is the northwestern view from Old Loop, from where the penal colony was once located. It is a desolate place, but it's beautiful because the painted desert runs through there. World War II had many effects on the Navajo people. I'm sure you've heard of some, but I will specifically talk about the establishment of the Loop Penal Colony. It's also known as the Citizen Isolation Camp. Call it whatever, but to us it was the Loop Penal Colony. It was established in Loop in 1942, and you all know what happened from our research findings. Japanese men who rose any questions about the violation of their civil rights, or those who questioned the illegal activities of the WRA, were arrested without due process, and they were either deported to Moab Camp in Moab, Utah, or to Loop. This is the Loop Agency. It was completed in 1908. These are some of the buildings that stood there. They're still standing, some of them. More buildings. At that place, they had office buildings, apartments, cottages, hospital, water tower, police station, a school, a dormitory, dining room, and a powerhouse. This is the old map. As you can see, I don't know if it makes sense, but if you look at that, you can see where those places were once located. And we verified them. We went out there and found where those buildings once stood. This is our infamous Little Colorado River that floods the Loop community. But now they have dams that are established, and not much flooding happens now. According to oral history, two major floods occurred, one in 1927, the second one in 1938, that caused extensive damages that forced the closure of the school buildings. Harry Ueno, he's the guy right there. He's the one who seemed to have documented his experiences both at Moab and at the Loop camp. And it's in that story, Years of Infamy, the untold story of America's concentration camps. That's a very helpful book. Lucien Long was one of the employees who worked at the Loop penal colony in the powerhouse. He talked about those men fixing a broken down vehicle, and they drove it inside the camp. And in Harry Ueno's book, he talked about a vehicle that he drove into Flagstaff to make grocery deliveries. So we're hoping that it's the same vehicle that the two men have talked about. As you can see, can you see the watchtower right there? And you see the fence? They weren't as heavily secured as at other concentration camps, but the Navajo eyewitnesses told us that camp was fenced in, and they had four watchtowers at each corner, and about 150 armed guards guarded the place and patrolled the area. And that's a picture of the school. And the Navajo people with eyewitnesses accounts told us that they were initially afraid of eyes narrow. That's the Navajo word. But in time, they've learned that they were friendly people, and they've actually learned to say yat'e, hello, as they pass the camp to get to the trading post. And most likely they have seen the Navajo mode of transportation, such as this. And most likely they have seen Navajo women and babies in cradle boards, just as what you see here. This is one of the club buildings there. It served as the headquarters and mess hall in 1943. The hospital people have told us, many of them were born here, including Sylvia Fredericks. In 1943, it served as the army barrack. Sylvia attended Old Loop School and she stayed in the dorm here. And she described it as a huge red sandstone building. After it closed, she transferred to Tuba City School, about some 90 miles north of Loop. In the summer of 43, she returned. As they passed the camp with she and her brother, her brother warned her not to look at the men or they would eat her. But of course, she looked. Nothing happened. And again, she commented on their friendliness. And she remembered that in the 60s, when the buildings began to crumble, she revisited to see Japanese writings on the walls. And she regrets not doing anything about saving them at the time. These are men in front of the residential building. A fun day at Loop. You can see one of the watchtowers there. Apparently they had a day of entertainment by the soldiers for the community people. And we believe that Japanese men were also among the attendees. Ralph McGee was a white trader who ran this trading post. He said he loaded up his truck with goods, drove it onto the camp to sell things. This is a wooden water tower that fell in 1958. The first one apparently was made of steel. Lucian Long lived a fascinating life, but he worked at Loop Penal Colony in the powerhouse. They used coal to produce electricity, and he worked with two Japanese men. Initially, he was afraid, but he grew to like them. He even invited them home for lunch, and we assume that they probably had mutton stew with fried bread. Paul Robertson was the camp director. And he spoke fondly of the Japanese men because he grew up with them in Northern California. We found newspaper articles that criticized Mr. Robertson for being so lenient that there were allegations that the Japanese men were seen on the Hopi Reservation attending snake dances. And of course, Robertson denied them, but we think they were there because he trusted them enough to let them leave the camp. And he was sensitive to their needs, and he released many of them from this camp to rejoin their families. And according to the National Archives records in Washington, D.C., the camp opened in February 1943 and closed 8 months later in December 1943. Due to budget problems. This is what you'll see today if you go there. Broken sidewalks. Most of the buildings were demolished in the early 70s because they were deemed a public hazard. People that loved to party ended up going there, and they hung around there, and they wanted the buildings destroyed. That's the way it looks when you look toward Old Loop. This is where the kitchen and the dining room once stood, broken dishes, ashes still scattered about. We measured this, my students and I. This is the foundation of the two-story residential building. That's all you'll see. The site of the old powerhouse, you'll still see a lot of coal chips there. And we tell this story because we want people to know that this camp once stood there in Loop, Arizona, on the Navajo Reservation. To this day, many people, even the Navajo people, still do not know. And we want them to know of the way it was. And these are some of my other research projects that you can find on the website. And my students have written poems about the loop, the former loop penal colony. If you are interested in reading some of them, you can contact me for those. And I also told Greg that I came across an article in the Moab newsletter about a historian who wrote about the Moab camp. And I can send that to you or to Allison. So anyway, that's my presentation in a nutshell.
Okay. My presentation will be an aspect of the Native American, so we'll continue on with that theme as we talk about Poston Relocation Center, or as I know it, Poston Concentration Camp. And I want to introduce my colleague, Dr. Michael Soce, who's the historian for the Colorado River Indian Tribes. We've become good friends as we've been doing research and talking about the Poston years. Back in 1991, I applied for a grant to do research from the California Civil Liberties Educational Project Program, CLEP for short. And I received that grant, so I went to the Colorado River Indian Reservation to do some research on Poston. I wanted to know how it got there, I mean, what the background was for this camp to be on an Indian reservation. And back in this, many years prior to that, I had started to do some artwork. And much to my surprise, as I worked on my pieces, the constant reminder of our years in Poston kept surfacing. And so I started to do artwork related to the internment. And finally I thought, well, it's probably a good idea to go to the reservation and really see what it's like today, as opposed to how I remembered it back in the 40s. I was 6 years old when the soldiers came with their rifles and bayonets, because our family was delayed in going to the Santa Anita racetrack. We all came down with the measles. And we had gotten vaccinated 2 weeks before to avoid the measles, and instead we came down with it. So we were left behind in San Diego while the rest of the Japanese American community was sent on to the Santa Anita racetrack. And so when we went to the Santa Anita Assembly Center, we rode on one of those army trucks, you know, with the canvas and the two benches alongside. And my mother was 6 months pregnant with my youngest brother. And she had to sit on that bench, hanging on for dear life. And she gave birth to my brother at the Santa Anita race. You know, they had converted one of the stables down there for a labor room for those women who were delivering babies. And when my brother was 2 weeks old, they put us on a train to Poston. And it was hot. It was August 28th when we arrived in Poston, and the temperature there goes as high as 120. It was the hottest summer that we had ever experienced. But there my little brother grew up the first 3 years of his life. But I, you know, with that kind of background, I still was thinking, well, I'd love to do some artwork. Maybe that helped me think through the psychological impact that the camp had on me. Even if I was very young at the time, it still was in my mind constantly. I felt still ashamed in my 30s. I went through a lot of therapy to try to deal with my feelings about being in Poston and about being in the Santa Anita racetrack compound. I took workshops, I took I went to counseling for 3 years. I mean, I did the whole rope that you need to do in order to resolve some of these childhood memories. And I read recently that children, the experiences that you have from the time you're 1 to 10, and most likely it's really 5 to 10 that you would consciously remember, those years impact your life for the rest. The rest of your life is impacted by the first 10 years of what you experienced. And this was a Dutch psychologist, a social psychologist, and when I was reading that, I thought, aha, no wonder I'm the way I am, because the first 10 years was as a POW, no wonder. Anyway, that helped me to think through on a more abstract level rather than the deep personal anguish I was feeling. And it started me on a journey to do artwork related to being in camp, my psychological journey into trying to deal with those years. So in 1999, I wrote to Mrs. Amelia Flores, who was the librarian there at the Colorado River Indian Reservation, and I asked her, could I come and do some research for my artwork? I want to know what was going on with the Native Americans on the reservation at the time we were there. And so she took my request and a sample of my drawing to the Tribal Council administration. And they wrote back and said that I could come. So I spent a week on the reservation combing through the archives. And I realized that they didn't have everything that I really would have liked to look at. So Amelia recommended I go to the National Archives in Laguna Niguel. So I went back to Berkeley, started some artwork, but then realized I really need some more background of what was happening at that time. So I applied for a civil liberties grant and received one. So I went down to Laguna Niguel for 1 week and searched through the National Archives there. And it was at that point that I discovered a document. It wasn't in the Bureau of Indian Affairs boxes. It was in a water section of the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And there I discovered the background of how and why Poston was developed on the reservation. One was John Collier, the Commissioner of Office of Indian Affairs at that time, wanted farmers, Japanese American farmers, and even Issei's, to come to the reservation to help them understand how to do agriculture on the reservation. And so his purpose was to have communities all up and down California be designated to come to Poston. Poston was built for 20,000 Japanese Americans. We never reached quite 20,000. I think the highest number was 19,000 something. But a lot of farmers came to Poston. And the Poston laborers, the Japanese internees, helped the Bureau of Indian Affairs to begin the process of digging irrigation ditches, canals, putting the concrete on the canals. And that was the first step towards bringing water from the Colorado River to the dried out, desolate reservation. Now that was just the first step, because later on in the 60s, the Job Corps came in and they did further development. But when I was doing the research, back in 1865, when the reservation was established, the government tried many, many times to bring water to the reservation. And it is so humorous reading some of that. You know, they didn't have the technology then, so they would dig ditches and then a thing would collapse when they tried getting the water out through these dirt irrigation ditches. So finally, when technology had come to the forefront, the Parker Dam was built, and then that allowed the irrigation, to be able to bring water to the reservation. And of course, the government needed justification for this small tribe of 1,200 to be able to have the big investment of having water brought to the reservation. So Commissioner John Collier thought, have a concentration camp on the reservation and they'll need water, and you'll have ready-made laborers to dig the ditches to bring the water. And that's what happened. The Japanese, Issei's, Nisei's worked on the irrigation ditches and canals. They also, Collier had another plan. He wanted school buildings, more permanent school buildings built. So eventually he had hoped to bring the Phoenix boarding school to Poston. That never happened. But he used the Japanese detainees to make handmade adobe bricks. If you go to Poston today, there isn't much left there, but the auditorium that the Japanese detainees built with these homemade, handmade adobe brick, that auditorium is still standing. But unfortunately, back in 2001, someone lit a torch to it, and the beautiful hardwood floor that the tribe had also upgraded and put on their floor was burnt. And so all you have left now is this adobe wall. But it is a reminder of what happened to the reservation and to the Japanese Americans who were sent there to Poston. Which brings me to my own personal feelings. You know, I had this passion. I wanted to know what it was like where my little brother nearly drowned in the wading pool when he was 2 years old. I have memories of Poston. So I wanted to really get behind into the history of it. So when I went back there and started to do the research, it really helped me to get over some of the anger and shame that I had. Mind you, I had nothing to do with the war, but I felt shame and anger. So going back to the reservation, meeting the tribal members, being able to do this research has been the most wonderful experience for me. And meeting people like Dr. Sosi and getting to know a little bit more about the Native Americans has been probably the best experience I've had in my life. So I'm very grateful that the Tribal Council was willing to allow me to come on their reservation and do the work, the research, and also to allow me to do some artwork.
I better get to it because Greg is very strict. But I want to thank people like Ruth and Sarah Begay, especially because my father was at Loop. So I feel a thank you for keeping that memory alive. I will be talking about Bronzeville in Los Angeles. I also received the California Civil Liberties grant to do this research. And the Bronzeville era of Little Tokyo in downtown Los Angeles only lasted about 3 short years, but it was very unique because it's really the only Japantown that was renamed by an African American enclave. But before I go into Bronzeville, I just wanted to point out that African Americans and Japanese Americans coexisted in this area that we refer to as Little Tokyo more than 100 years ago, because to illustrate this point, Reverend William J. Seymour, an African American minister from Texas, and he's also the founder of the modern Pentecostal movement, he started his ministry in an abandoned warehouse on Azusa Street. And Azusa Street is an alleyway right now next to the Japanese American Cultural and Community Center. And the reason why he started it there, because back in 1906, that was an African American enclave. And in fact, there's a Los Angeles Times December 22nd, 1904 article that refers to this area as the Negro Tenderloin. So anyways, that's back then, but let's fast forward to the 1940s. Pearl Harbor was bombed on December 7th, 1941. By the spring of 1942, the United States government had issued eviction and incarceration orders for Japanese Americans on the West Coast. So almost overnight, all the Japan towns up and down the West Coast became ghost towns. There is a July 12, 1942 Los Angeles Times article which reports that the white Little Tokyo building owners were discussing plans to convert the empty Little Tokyo area into a Latin American quarter, which would house trade organizations and consulates from Latin America. But that didn't happen. Instead, thousands of African Americans, mainly from the Deep South, came out to the West Coast to work in the defense industry, which was facing a huge labor shortage. And a lot of these African Americans were forced to live in the empty Japan towns because most areas had restrictive housing covenants, which prevented people of color from living in white neighborhoods. So in Little Tokyo, before the war, there was an estimated 30,000 Japanese Americans living in the Little Tokyo district. Now, during the war, the Los Angeles County Health Department estimated that more than 80,000 African Americans and a few Latinos were squeezed into this area. And so when you have that many people, you're going to have slum conditions, and you would read newspaper reports or magazine reports where you could have like 16 people living in this tiny little room, or 40 people sharing one bathroom, or there were structures where there were no bathrooms. And there was this popular term called hotbeds, where like when one person got out of bed, someone else got in, because that's how crowded it was. And there was a lot of communicable diseases, tuberculosis, venereal diseases. And these conditions were not unique to Little Tokyo. All the similar patterns were in other Japan towns. And just to illustrate this point, there is a 1943-44 biennial report by the California State Division of Immigration and Housing. And I'm going to quote from that. And some of the words may be offensive, but I'm just quoting. And it says, quote, "Negroes are moving into the deserted Japtown districts of our metropolitan centers in vast numbers, and conditions of sanitation are generally poor, and overcrowding is a major difficulty. We have succeeded in cleaning out several of the smaller abandoned Japtown districts throughout California, and through abatement actions and misdemeanor prosecutions, we have had a large number of old, dilapidated frame shacks razed to make way for new buildings." End of quote. So in Los Angeles, to assist these newcomers, the Los Angeles County Social Services Department formed this special Little Tokyo Committee. And this committee helped form Pilgrim House, which was a social service agency. And it was housed at the old Union Church, which today is the Union Center for the Arts, where East West Players is housed at. And there was a chair, Ms. Catherine Kaplan. She was the Little Tokyo Committee chair. She wrote to then California Governor Earl Warren asking for state assistance. And she noted in her letter that the overcrowding conditions was making situation ripe for epidemics, vice, and race riots. And there actually was a race riot in early June 1943. And that was between the Anglo servicemen and the Latino youths in what we know as the Zoot Suit Riots. And the chaos spilled into Little Tokyo. And one of the most graphic incidents that I've come across is, it was reported in the June 17th, 1943 California Eagle, which was an African-American newspaper. And it reported that a mob gouged out the eye of Louis W. Jackson, age 23. Who was an African-American resident of Little Tokyo who had moved from Louisiana that February to work in the shipyards. So as the housing situation for African Americans got worse, Los Angeles Mayor Fletcher Bowron started to hold emergency housing meetings. And the city health office inspector served 140 abatement notices in Little Tokyo, ordering these people to move out due to substandard conditions. But the only problem is these people had nowhere to go. So the federal government stepped in late 1943, and the Federal Housing Authority proposed to build temporary housing for African Americans in the Willowbrook area, which was then a white neighborhood next to Watts and Compton. So the white residents protested. They said their property value was going to go down. There were threats of race riots and revival of the Ku Klux Klan. And everybody from the sheriffs all the way up to the governor were monitoring the situation. Now, on a positive note, around the same time in October 1943, Mr. Leonard Christmas, who was an African-American businessman who ran the Digby Hotel in Little Tokyo, announced at a Little Tokyo meeting that the area was no longer Little Tokyo. And that same month, the Bronzeville Chamber of Commerce opened their office on San Pedro Street. And because there were so many people in Bronzeville, they had a very active nightlife. And there were a lot of clubs. One of the most popular clubs there was called Shep's Playhouse. And that was on the corner of First and Los Angeles Street. And currently, the new Ohtani Hotel is standing there, which was recently named the Kyoto Hotel. And you had people like a lot of Hollywood types, Gene Kelly, Judy Garland would come out there. And Foster Johnson, who was the premier tap dancer at the time, produced a floor show there. Just as a little trivial thing, he later married Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura on Star Trek. But later during the war, Foster Johnson opened the Finale Club in Bronzeville, and Charlie Parker's, he played there. And people, big names like Charlie Parker, the Lionel Hampton Band, they stayed at the Civic Hotel, which was on the corner of First and San Pedro Street. After the war, that became the Miyako Hotel. And then in the 60s, that got torn down, and it's currently the Kajima Building. But let's see, it was at the Civic Hotel that Charlie Parker had his infamous nervous breakdown, and he set his mattress on fire, and he came down to the hotel lobby in a drug haze naked, and the LAPD came and beat him up and took him away in a straitjacket. But, okay, that's Charlie Parker. By early 1945, the United States government were releasing the Japanese Americans, and they were returning to the West Coast. And for the most part, the transition from Bronzeville back to Little Tokyo went smoothly. Either the Japanese Americans bought out the businesses of the Bronzeville business leases, or the Little Tokyo building owners were not renewing the rental leases of the Bronzeville businesses. And Mr. Satoru Ueda, who is widely recognized as the first Japanese American to return to Little Tokyo and open up a business, bought out the lease to the Bronzeville 5, 10, 25 cent store. And he, in order to foster good relations, he hired African Americans. And then in turn, there were African Americans like Mr. Samuel Evans, who ran the Bamboo Room restaurant. He hired returning Japanese Americans. And there was another, excuse me, I ate too much during lunch. There was another African-American newspaper called the Los Angeles Tribune, and they put out an ad in the Pacific Citizen, which is the Japanese American Citizens League's newspaper, and award-winning writer Hisai Yamamoto was one of three Japanese Americans to work at the Tribune, and award-winning playwright Wakako Yamauchi babysat the children of Almina Lomax, who was the publisher and editor of the Tribune. And then later on, Crossroads, which was another Japanese American publication, was printed at the tritium plant. Now, as Japanese Americans were trying to reestablish their lives, African Americans were faced with a new problem. They were, as the defense industry came to a halt, they were getting fired or laid off. Okay, 5 minutes, he tells me. Let me see. So, I'm just going to go very briefly. There were some lawsuits that Japanese Americans were involved with after the war, but not too many. But the longest running Bronzeville era business was that of Mr. James Hodge. He opened up a newspaper stand on the corner of First and San Pedro in front of the Civic Hotel in 1942, and he was still there well into the 1980s. And he's quoted in this book called Little Tokyo, 100 Years in Pictures. He's already passed away. But Mr. Hodge described the Bronzeville period as, quote, "This neighborhood here was nightclubs and gambling and prostitutes and pimps. But they weren't like today. They were civilized. The sun never went down in this neighborhood. Guys were spending money with both hands. It was real exciting. But it only lasted about 3 years. Thank you.
We certainly have cut to the bone. The presentations are all the more remarkable for having been so short. So I will follow suit and give a very brief commentary and then let the panelists discuss among themselves if there's any wish that they have to comment on each other's panels, and then we'll throw it open to all of you. I think that, again, all three papers show the enormous importance of space. You know, that we talk about the personal is political, here is the spatial is political. On the one hand, when Japanese Americans and other groups come into close physical contact, they become friendly, they make connections between each other, they are able to help each other. But that said, first, it occurs in a context where their contact is manipulated, set up, serving the interests of dominant white groups. In the case of Loop, Japanese Americans get to know Navajo because they're confined without any due process. In the case of Poston, it's because John Collier dreams of improving life for the residents of the Colorado River Reservation and realizes the only way he can get it is by using the Japanese Americans. Although interestingly, he writes to the War Relocation Authority that he doesn't want just another concentration camp in Poston. If it's just going to be that, the hell of it. But if it's going to be a model community that can set up cooperatives and set up irrigation, then he's all for it. And he recruits a whole number of people. And one thing that Ms. Okamoto did not say is that there actually was a whole staff of social scientists and specialized workers recruited to Poston, including the sculptor Isamu Noguchi, who volunteered to be interned, and including a number of African-American nurses and teachers who relieved a teaching shortage. In fact, Ms. Okamoto's brother has told me that he had an African-American school teacher for first grade, and that his fifth grade gym teacher was an African-American. I think that the point of Martha Nakagawa's speech is that, again, even when there's contact, it can lead to competition, it can lead to overcrowding, it can lead to epidemics. So sometimes familiarity breeds, if not contempt, then at least difficulties. But I think the lesson of this is that properly managed, properly understood, properly organized, that the bringing together, the sharing of space, the sharing of lives by members of different communities helps them to understand their own lives, helps them to understand their own relations. I mean, Ms. Okamoto's, again, personal experience is very poignant here, that through her contact with the Colorado River Reservation, through her contact with the historians there, with the community there, she's been able to produce not only a change in her own life, but extraordinary art. So I ask the panelists whether they have any comments on each other's presentations.
Well, I wanted to say something to
Sarah.
Sorry. You had talked about the Navajo. I mean, that's your background. But you might be interested to know, and I don't know if you knew this, but in 1945, 17 families from the Hopi Reservation came to post in Camp 2. And they are still, their descendants are still there on the reservation, right, Michael? And then in 1947, some families of the Navajo tribe came down to Camp 2. And they are still there on the reservation. So back in the 40s, it was the Mojaves and Chimaweves, but then the Navajos and Hopis became official tribal members of the Colorado River Indian tribes. I just thought that you might be interested to know that there's a connection between the Navajos and the posting camps.
Thank you.
Thank you. these connections are have not really been explored yet, and I think one of the things that makes some discussion of this in sort of traditional American history is that this brings up very uncomfortable themes in 20th century United States history. And in particular, one of the reasons that the camps are located on reservations is that it was easy within the federal government to locate camps like this on reservations because it just took someone's signature. Whereas when they were locating other camps, they had problems with other property owners to, you know, nobody wanted Japanese, so why would you do that? It's kind of like today locating a nuclear waste dump. So most people don't want those types of facilities.
We should mention that Del Webb, the contractor who later owned the New York Yankees, made a fortune out of building Poston.
Well, they got their start at Poston, and then he built all the retirement homes in Phoenix during the 50s and 60s. So Del Webb's fortunes started from the construction of the Poston internment camp, but and they're not very proud of that connection, so I might add. But these issues of what I think is extraordinary is that the racism that existed in 20th century American history, what these stories show is that how these different populations of Americans transcend that and create spaces that they share, that they live together, that they create something way beyond what anybody would have expected or what anybody would know about. And I think this is the challenge for our generation now, is to begin to explore those themes and to discuss these issues, because they really are an important part of our history. But for certain segments of the American population, they're very uncomfortable parts of the national history. And one of the things that I think for us as tribal members, realizing that there's very little difference between what happened to Jews in Europe as to what happened to Japanese Americans in the United States. The only thing, there just wasn't a gas chamber. But the concentration, relocation, and they call, you know, the euphemisms that they use for this time period in terms of resettlement and assembly centers, it's very reminiscent of kind of what was going on in Europe. And so, you know, our national history, they try to make a distinction, but there's really very little distinction. I think the presentation we had at lunchtime today discussing an American standing up for civil liberties and for the rights of all Americans is very important. And that's something that, you know, we should be emphasizing even into this day, because we do have these examples of history repeating itself, which it shouldn't or need not repeat itself. But with the connection with the Native Americans, especially on our reservation, what I'm hoping that people will begin to, one of the difficulties about Poston, it was the largest camp in the system, but there's very little history about Poston. And part of that is because it had this Native American connection. But I think also is that the themes that come about from the actual history of the camp is it's very troubling. And so it's very complicated, and so people tend to shy away from doing any history about things that are a little bit more complicated than what people wanted to make it, I guess. But the things that I would hope people would realize is that, and we had an opening of a documentary that was produced about Poston called Passing Poston earlier this year. For the people that suffered through that camp experience, what they don't realize is that afterwards, because of what happened. For the Native American population that was on the reservation, our lives were greatly improved. People like myself would not exist if it hadn't been for that experience that occurred. So out of that tremendous suffering, there was just an enormous improvement in another minority population's life. And it made all the difference for us. And that's something that I would hope that the community, Japanese American community, and their descendants would realize, is that that experience created opportunity and it created tremendous economic opportunities for my community. And that's something that I don't think has ever been discussed in terms of maybe a positive outcome that came from that. But the lasting legacy that you left us is just immeasurable. And we have a debt to the Japanese American community because of that connection. And that's something that I really want to emphasize. And that is something that we will continue to acknowledge and recognize. And that is something I think is very important. That's one of them, maybe a positive outcome that came out of that very negative experience.
Could I just add two sentences? Michael mentioned what was going on the reservation. I found out later that the tribe did not have running water. They did not have flushing toilets such as we had in Poston. They were living underground. They had to dig underground because there was no air conditioning for the tribes. And to think that they were living underground while we had eventually had coolers, it made me really think about what American history and life is all about. So I just think the tribes at that time were suffering more than we were in Poston.
The floor is open.
Can I make a really brief comment about, since we're talking about Native Americans, that the draft resistors from Amachi and Topaz and Poston were at the Santa Catalina prison camp, that Mary Farrell there and her husband Jeff Burton did a wonderful job in terms of having it renamed a Gordon Hitabayashi campsite. But there were Hopi and Navajo draft resistors there also, and they shared that space. And I just wanted to make that comment that the draft resistors also share that space.
I was thinking about what to say. I just shared with Paul, or was it you, Martha, that there were parallels between the Japanese and the Navajo people, because some, when you mentioned 1868, somebody did here, or in 1864, the Navajo people were rounded up because we were in the way of finding gold and silver on our land, so we were relocated to Fort Sumner, New Mexico, and we were held there. I call it a concentration camp as well. We were held there, detained there for 4 years. And then on June 1st, 1868, our leaders had signed the peace treaty. Only then were we allowed to return to our original homeland. But the plan was to have us relocated to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory. But it just so happened that those people in power, the government, didn't want any more Native Americans relocated to Oklahoma. So for that reason, we returned to our homeland. So there are parallels. Yes.
The question is about the Diné who were guards at the Loup Penal Colony.
We asked if any of those guards were Navajo. They were all, they were non-Navajo.
Except in
The workers, yeah. Some of the workers like Lucian, he worked in the powerhouse, and I'm sure the custodians and those people performing lower paying jobs were most likely Navajo.
The guards had to be Caucasians. In a couple of cases in the southern camps, African Americans were made honorary Caucasians for the purpose, but in general, they were non-whites were barred from those jobs because probably because of the fear they'd be too friendly. Yes.
I am very dark. I love making jewelry. And in the last 13, 15 years, I've been connected with the Gila River tribes. People from the Navajo country, Hopis would come in and they would talk to me in the native tongue. And I would say, I don't understand you. I don't want to speak your language. And they would think that I was a
Navajo.
Navajo anyway. And so I have a very close affiliation and a very love for the Navajo people. As a matter of fact, I have been elected to their tribal, and I have been awarded. I have been awarded one of their medals that they give to their speakers, or Navajo code talkers. And so I have a very close relationship, which I love to talk about. But to add a little bit of personal items to her story concerning Loop. I happen to be a friend of Nimasu Oishi, who used to live in Guadalupe, California, and his two brothers. And we graduated the same class in 1938 from the Santa Maria Union High School. And we went through the series of moving through Tulare and finally to the Gila River Indian Reservation. But I went into the service. But the other three brothers, they stayed behind. And after I came out of the service, I found out that Nimashi had been taken to the Loop detention center. And I'm not so sure whether that's a Justice Department camp or not, but Nimashi was a person who graduated high school and was sent to Japan. He got a Japanese education. And when he came back, his status as a Kibei was a very strong factor in his fact for being watched by the army for the very simple reason that he did not favor some of the thoughts that were expressed, which I didn't know about. But the fact is, after I came out, I said, Nimashi, how are you getting along? Oh, he says, I had a terrible time. I was sent to Loop. Where's Loop? I lived in Arizona. I didn't even know where Loop was. But anyway, he told me his story that he was picked up because of his words against what the government was trying to impose upon the Nisei. But when he was sent to Loop, he tells me the story that as he was in the camp, the camp commander recognized his possibilities and recommended that he go into the language school. But what happened since then, he told Robertson, the commander, that he wanted to marry Chutumita from Guadalupe, the oldest girl, and wanted the permission to go there to get married. And Robertson said, well, why not? He actually took him by auto back to the campsite, Gila River, and they had a marriage ceremony. Okay? And ever since then, I've had a very close connection with that family, and I have a feeling that Robertson and Nimashi Oishi had a very close relationship. As a matter of fact, Colonel Robertson's kids were watched by
yes.
Nimashi,
mm-hmm.
taken care of. And this, I think, is just a little sidelight into the experience I've had with Loop and also the Navajo people. Uh, I I feel that it's a very honor on my part to have known someone who was sent to a Justice Department camp, claimed to be a terrible Japanese, a possible saboteur or someone who would do harm to the American people. He is a good example. He was a good example of his expressing his opinions, yet at the same time being honest with himself and with the people. I think he's Nimashi is an outstanding person that should be remembered, and I do, for the simple reason he had the courage to stand up and say, "Hey, you might be making a mistake. I may be an American born, but educated in Japan. My feelings are for the United States. I'll be glad to go into the service at any time." But he had an injury which prevented him from joining the Army. I just wanted to bring that out to you.
Thank you, because our research report is about this thick. What I've shared with you is just a little bit. But yes, Robertson did allow someone to leave the camp to get married. You verified that. And so it's the same person who babysat his own children. Isn't that beautiful? Thank you. And then talking about Navajos resembling Japanese, I mistook a Mr. Sosi for her. No offense, Mr. Sosi, but I guess you know that right after the bombing of the Pearl Harbor, this is so beautiful history of a white mission, the son of a Kansas missionary grew up in Loup, Philip Johnston. He spoke fluent Navajo. He's the very same person who proposed the idea of using the Navajo language to send military codes in the war in the South Pacific. And I mean, this originated out of Loup, and several code talkers, the original code talkers, are from Loup area. And during that time, the Japanese did mistake Navajos for Japanese.
I can't resist adding that the founder of the California Indian and Cowboy Artists, who was a great leader in the revival of Native American artist and patronage in the early 70s, Gilbert E.Z. Chino, was in fact born Yone Chino, a Japanese American in Chicago, of Cherokee ancestry as well on his mother's side. You, sir.
Just making connections, Billy Allen. Billy Allen, Gila River Indian Community. And I got involved with the project for the Enduring Communities, led by our famous Dr. Karen Mion back there. But my lesson was to make it a local connection. I was born and raised just 2 miles north of the Japanese relocation camp. American history, World War II, the Native Americans, it's well documented. Co-talkers, Ira Haynes, the Bushmasters. So I didn't want to repeat all that stuff, but when I saw Gordon Urebayashi and that civil disobedience, I knew about an Indian person down south of us, the Thone Oregon Reservation, right? A man who basically did not want his tribal, the youth of his tribe, to reach the Collective Service Act. By that act of disobedience, it escalated for the federal marshals in Tucson who wanted to commission a plane, tanks, grenades, and wanted to bomb the village simply because this man would not allow his tribal youth to do that. Long short, he was captured and taken into federal custody and sent to a federal prison in Montana. That's what I tried to put. Again, it's a correlation with Gordon Urebayashi, Congregation Jector. The funny story with him is when he was sentenced, they told him from San Francisco, and he reported to this penitentiary in Tucson. He It took him 2 weeks to get down there. They didn't want to pay for it, so he hitchhiked. But he got as far as, I think, the lights over there, just to hop the bus. He made his way out of Tucson, got to the camp, said, I'm here reporting for my prison sentence. They said, you don't have your stuff. I'm here. They said, you don't have anything. Go back to the town. Relax, come back later. Dinner fixture comes in later. Oh, no, we got your thing. Now you can serve. And that's that camp that you're to meet there. Anyway, so those are the two things that I term, you know, and the Hopis are still there. The last thing, again, talking in circles, but the other thing that may strike outsiders, I think you alluded to it, Dr. Sosi, that they're on reservation land, and it may look like they are trashed. In reality, they are. A lot of it goes back to this question of sovereignty. Gila River had no choice. The material, I mean, everything was built. The infrastructure was there. Everything was built, and the Indian people still objected. It was not until later when the government explained to them, if you okay it on paper, these buildings which are standing here, if you okay it, then you can start charging money for some of the crops. You can lease the land. In essence, then you will get some money coming in. And at that point, the tribe literally had their hands tied to say, okay, we'll do that. It goes back to a lot of stuff that you're saying. A lot of the stuff went through. And again, you can imagine, you know, people that have housing, 3 square meals, and you can debate whether they're 3 square meals or not, whereas people less than 2 miles away don't have that luxury. You can see some of that. Thank you.
I'm afraid we're out of time. With all the interesting stories, the panelists are still here, ready to talk to you, and we hope that will be more dialogue. Thank you very much for attending. Thank you for all the comments.